The Allegheny Front is made possible in part by listeners like you. To add your support, please click donate at AlleghenyFront.org.
About 5 million gallons of water are pumped underground to get gas and oil out of each of the 8,000 fracking sites in the Marcellus Shale. That's a lot of water, folks. What happens to the leftover water after the fracking?
You've got water that has a tremendous amount of salt in it.
I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. This week on the Allegheny Front, businesses try to clean up that briny water. Plus, we follow scientists into a hemlock forest as they try to tackle an invasive insect. And what's a butterbutt eat to survive the winter? I kid you not, people call one bird the butterbutt. Stay tuned to learn about this and more on the Allegheny Front. Pennsylvania environmentalists are none too pleased with the way the state legislative session ended this week. Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future, a.k.a. Penn Futures President Cindy Dunn, joins me on the Allegheny Front to talk about some of the bills that passed at the 11th hour. Cindy, thanks for checking in.
Hi, how are you?
One bill that passed Wednesday was a response to President Obama's Clean Power Plan. It gives legislators power to approve whatever the State Department of Environmental Protection's plans are for complying to the EPA rule. Now, this was earlier approved by the House. Those who opposed this bill said it puts politicians above scientists in dealing with climate change. So what's Penn Futures' take on this legislation, Cindy?
Yeah, you've got it right. It inappropriately inserts both the Senate and or the House into a process where the Department of Environmental Protection in Pennsylvania is required to submit a plan. So it's really forcing them to cede their power and their responsibility to the citizens to create a plan that meets the EPA rule. And further, by doing so, it could cause a delay in creating a plan that's acceptable to EPA, which will force the required EPA producing the plan for Pennsylvania. And so I think Pennsylvanians would rather produce their own plan, and the agency charged, you know, by the legislature, by law in Pennsylvania, is DEP to produce a plan. So it's really inappropriate for the legislature to assert themselves strongly into this process.
We also spoke with Representative Pam Snyder. She's a Democrat here in the southwestern part of the state, and she sponsored this legislation in the House. And here's how she explained it.
This is to ensure that everybody who represents their districts has a voice and a say in this process, because that's what we're elected to do. I have watched my coal-fired power plants be closed. I have watched people lose their jobs. I have watched electricity rates skyrocket. I have watched electric reliability be in jeopardy.
Let's touch on the House bill dealing with the state's cleanest streams. It eliminates 150-foot buffer zones required between new developments and high-quality waterways. Now, rows of trees and shrubs can help keep pollution from washing off buildings and pavement into streams and rivers, but developers have said waterfront property is valuable and 150 feet can be too much to ask. We talked to Marsha Hahn, the Republican sponsor of the bill. She's from Northampton County. She said the legislation gives landowners options to use either the riparian forest buffer or other methods to protect waterways. Anton says the Department of Environmental Protection still has final say.
DEP has to approve it. When it gets down to it, that might be the only option some of the landowners have. They may not be able to do any of the other best management practices, but at least it's giving them an option. So if they can do a riparian buffer on the same waterway to keep the water the way it is, you know, keep it clean, then they have that option.
I should also note that an earlier report by State Impact Pennsylvania pointed out that the DEP has never denied a waiver to a company that requested one in terms of this buffer. Cindy, how do you at Penn Future respond to Representative Hahn's argument?
What's interesting, House Bill 1565, around the office we call it the subdivision flooding bill. Forest riparian buffers are the natural state of Pennsylvania streams, and so much of our land has been developed, and so much of the habitat has changed. 150 feet is actually a fairly narrow buffer. houses can be attractively built and placed, you know, 150 feet away, saving that buffer and preserving the natural features of the buffer to absorb flood water and clean it before it heads its way downstream. This is unfortunately really reversing a good practice we had in Pennsylvania for years of preserving these buffers, and it's really kowtowing to the developers and the home builders who really just want the ability to build closer and closer to the stream and eliminate this restriction. And unfortunately, it's this restriction that protects the downstream users.
And about how many streams are affected by this legislation?
About 25% of Pennsylvania streams are either high quality or exceptional value, with high quality being the vast percentage. It was pointed out when a home builder or developer is working on a site, already some flexibility built into the system. So this law, again, is usurping the administrative branch of government's job. It's usurping DEP's job to protect the environment and really look at the factors and really understand them. And so that a waiver, I mean, we frankly at Penn Future think there are too many waivers. But however, at least that's being done through the regulatory agency with trained staff to do that, and not just carte blanche, you know, across the system, which will have a detrimental impact.
There were other bills you were tracking, one to establish private water well standards. How did that fare?
Water well protection standards stand out as something in Pennsylvania that a real gap that was never filled in our regulatory program. About half of Pennsylvanians depend on water wells, and there are no standards for their construction and no real enforcement that protects Pennsylvanians. I think many Republicans and Democrats see the need to fill, but unfortunately, it didn't get through.
Well, thanks very much for talking with me.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. This is the Allegheny Front. I've been speaking with Penn Future President Cindy Dunn about the Pennsylvania State Legislature's votes as the session wrapped up this week. In Washington, D.C. next month, environmentalists who have made their way across the country are planning to pressure the Obama administration to stop using fossil fuels. They're part of the Great March for Climate Action that began in spring in Los Angeles. The protesters just rallied in Ohio and Pennsylvania and met with local fracking activists. The Allegheny Front's Kara Halsoppel caught up with them in a rural community north of Pittsburgh.
On a sunny Saturday afternoon, activists gather in Diamond Park, across from the Butler County Courthouse. This is part of the Global Frackdown, one of many protests worldwide against fracking for oil and gas. These locals are also waiting, expectantly, for a busload of marchers that have been traveling, mostly walking, across the country.
My name is Lisa DeSantis, and I am an activist clown. Since it's a radio show, you can't see that I have tears of oil dripping down my face.
DeSantis came from the next county over. She thinks fracking should be banned because it can contaminate water.
No one's listening to us. We're just trying to protect what is ours, and we're mama bears standing up with our claws out, ready to attack back at this industry.
Michael Bagdas Canning is wearing a ball cap loaded with anti-fracking buttons. He's with Marcellus Outreach Butler, and he's juggling a cell phone and clipboard because he's the organizer of today's rally. He says his group and others have had small successes, like stopping a new well pad from being built near Lake Arthur, used for fishing and recreation.
Today, we're celebrating a bunch of things. We're also trying to convince people they aren't alone.
A yellow school bus pulls up to the curb alongside the park.
The climate marchers are here!
The procession of about 50 climate marchers melts into the crowd of 100 or so local activists. Lee Stewart is a kind of quiet young man from Virginia. He's just spoken publicly and emotionally to the crowd about joining the climate march to provide a better future for his nephew.
And I guess another reason I joined the march is to try to find hope, because looking around Virginia, I see all of these projects coming up, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the compressor stations. No matter what we say and what we do, it seems like they're always approved and we don't really have a voice.
In September, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approved the Cove Point LNG export project in Maryland. When the march reaches D.C. in November, Stewart and others will ask them to reconsider. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapple.
What goes up must come down. Spinning wheel, got to go round. Talking about your troubles, it's a crying sin. Ride a painted pony, let the spinning wheel spin.
Ah, yes, I think of that song and Isaac Newton every time I consider fracking. But in the case of fracking, what goes down must come up. After drillers use chemical-laced water to break up shale underground, releasing oil and gas, what's left is tons of brine, flowback, or maybe the catchiest name, produced water. Some businesses think they can clean up this leftover water, but others doubt they'll ever make a profit. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Inside a big industrial building not far from downtown Pittsburgh, Mike Broker shows off what he hopes is the next big thing in cleaning up the fracking industry.
We have 3 8-foot diameter satellite dishes. These are the most common satellite dishes in the world, typically used for radio communications.
You might say these are no ordinary satellite dishes, but that's the thing. These are totally ordinary satellite dishes. What Broker's company puts on the surface of these dishes. Now, that's the not-so-ordinary thing going on here.
You can see it here, and this has a covering on it. But this is a kind of a vinyl-type material that does have some flexibility to it that allows you to get about 95% reflectivity.
That reflectivity is crucial. The company's called Epiphany Solar Water Systems. It uses solar energy to distill clean water. The company was started a few years ago to clean up drinking water in the developing world. But then something else came along.
And then came the Marcellus Shale opportunity.
Each well that's fracked in the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania produces about 1 million gallons of dirty water. And you can't just flush this down the drain. Fracking companies are now reusing a lot of this water for other frack jobs, or they're sending it to deep injection wells, often in Ohio. But injection comes with its own problems, like earthquakes, so cleaning the water up could make financial and environmental sense. Epiphany reworked its technology to deal with this fracking wastewater. Epiphany's system uses those satellite dishes and converts them into intense solar heat collectors. Through a series of pipes, it heats up the dirty frack water in a contraption the size of a dorm fridge.
It's what's called a mechanical vapor recompression crystallizer.
It's basically a still, the same contraption bootleggers use to make moonshine.
The same concept. It is distillation.
They make whiskey, but you guys make...
pure water.
Broker hopes the company's contraption will be deployed on well pads throughout the Marcellus Shale and other places. It's already got 3 in the field with different gas companies, though he can't say which ones. The system is designed to clean up produced water. That's the water that flows out of a well continuously, along with gas and other liquids, after it's been put into production. That water has been sitting underground for hundreds of millions of years, and that makes for a headache to clean up.
You've got water that that has a tremendous amount of salt in it, about 18% salt. By example, the ocean has about 3-4% salt.
Salt destroys equipment, so Epiphany has had to use materials that won't corrode. The salt also presents a challenge to other technologies Epiphany is competing with. Reverse osmosis, for instance, uses a membrane, essentially a filter, to strain the salt out of seawater. To get the water through the membrane, you have to apply pressure to it. But the saltier the water, the more pressure you need.
The issue is that with flowback water and produced water, the salinity is so high that you have to push very, very hard. And that risks rupturing the membrane.
Megan Motter is an engineer at Carnegie Mellon University. Motter's team has created a special membrane that will allow water vapor to go through it, but no liquids. Dirty water stays back, clean vapor travels through.
There it goes.
In her lab at Carnegie Mellon, Motter shows how the system works.
There is now water coming out of this reservoir, coming in here, across the membrane, and then discharging back there.
Salty water is heated up and piped to a tiny membrane, a small white semicircle of plastic cloth. On the other side of the membrane, there's cold water, so through simple condensation, clean water flows out of the system. The key, though, is getting the membrane just right, Motter says.
So this particular sample is a millipore membrane. It's very similar to the polymer that is used to make Gore-Tex.
Motter says she's a long way from having a product that can be commercialized. But if there's ever a machine that can clean up frack water cheaply, some think it will have no shortage of buyers. The research firm Lux found the market for wastewater treatment from oil and gas is about $1 billion right now, and it could grow to $9 billion by the next decade. But not everyone thinks that these new technologies will ever make that money. Brent Giles studies the water market for Lux. He says a lot of startups got into the market thinking they could solve the frack water problem.
A lot of the startups that we see in produced water, in flowback water, are fairly naive, and they've got a solution. And as soon as they started seeing frack water issues show up in the New York Times and newspapers like that, they kind of did a 180 and decided that they were going to become experts in the oil and gas space. And that hasn't worked out for a lot of them.
Why hasn't it worked out? Well, Giles says it's the water.
In the Marcellus, most of these technologies, these more advanced technologies, have utterly failed to treat the water. It's such low quality water that the technologies crash and burn when they try to treat it.
In contrast, companies that use more low-tech solutions, like prepping the wastewater to be reused in future frack jobs, have been much more successful. Part of the problem is that the type and quantity of water produced in oil and gas wells changes over the lifetime of a well. There's a lot of water that comes out during fracking. After the well is fracked, the well goes into production. During that period, the water that comes out of the well gradually gets saltier and saltier over time. Also, there's a lot less of it than when it's getting fracked. So creating a technology to treat all those scenarios is difficult. Giles says it's just cheaper and easier to reuse that frack water or inject it underground.
Well, we've seen a lot of people try, and we've seen a lot of people just not meet the numbers that the oil companies are asking for.
Broker of Epiphany Solar Water says his company is already meeting the price point the industry wants, and others say those prices are subject to change. Annie Lane is with the research firm Battelle. Lane is working on a reverse osmosis system that uses multiple membranes.
The industry is very interested in potential changes in policy and regulations.
Lane says she's getting more interest from oil and gas companies and technologies like hers that can deal with this dirty water.
They see continued use of injection wells actually as being threatened due to possible changes in policy. So they're interested in identifying alternatives.
She thinks one day the water will be more valuable cleaned up and above ground than pumped down a hole. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
That story was part of our Exposures reporting series on shale and water issues. More coverage at AlleghenyFront.org/exposures. Next week, we explore more about the water left over from fracking with a look at an issue that's largely under the radar, spills of the flowback water. Pennsylvania's top fracking regulator calls it
the most critical environmental issue associated with the activity.
Our special Exposures series on fracking and water continues next week on the Allegheny Front. For the past several decades, hemlock trees across the East Coast have become home to an invasive insect that's leaving their host trees dead in the ground. Efforts to manage the blight continue deep in a West Virginia swamp. Two chapters of the Nature Conservancy, state agencies from Maryland and West Virginia, and the U.S. Forest Service have all come together to see that whatever can be done is done to manage the hemlock woolly adelgid. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glynis Board reports.
So we're at Cranesville Swamp in Preston County, West Virginia, and this is a place that's pretty well known by people that are nature lovers, birders, botanists, things like that.
Mike Powell, stewardship manager for the Nature Conservancy, explains that the swamp is kind of a natural relic left over from the last ice age some 15,000 years ago. It's preserved in what's called a frost pocket, where because of the elevation, the level of precipitation, climatic conditions, and a couple of other key factors, a very unique ecology exists. Today, it's home to rare snails, artesian wells, carnivorous plants, and a bunch of hemlock trees. Hemlock trees are what's known as a keystone species, meaning they are fundamental players in the forest ecologies where they grow, critical to the mountain water systems that they hug. Those that live in the eastern United States are sick and dying. Humans inadvertently introduced a tiny parasitic insect here called a hemlock woolly adelgid, which is native to hemlock trees in Japan. Since they were introduced in 1950, slowly but surely, tens of thousands of these evergreens across the East Coast are already dead.
If you're in Blackwater Canyon, looking down into the canyon, you can see hundreds or thousands of dead hemlock in the canyon. And hemlock in the eastern part of the state is largely dead on the other side of the Allegheny Front. There's pockets of good-looking trees here and there, but like Shenandoah National Park is believed to be almost hemlock-free at this point because all the hemlock there have died over time.
That's Tim Toman, forest entomologist with the West Virginia Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, the hemlock, the way it shades the forest or, you know, the area that it's in all year round, since they have their needles all year, they create a shaded environment underneath them. And in many areas of the state, it's growing over cold, high mountain streams, so it helps keep those streams cold. And in here, it's shading the forest. So when you come into parts of Cranesville and it's, you know, you've got big pockets of almost solid hemlock, yeah, when you lose that, it would definitely have a major impact.
The hemlocks grow 60 to 100 feet tall. And if you look at the underside of their needles, you can identify them by the white lines you see there. And if while you're looking at the underside of the needles, you also see little white puffs near the base of the needles. You might be staring at little sap suckers that are draining the life from the tree in your hands.
I had heard that, when they insert themselves into the tree, they're effectively causing a wound that is stimulating the autoimmune response of the tree that sends energy to that wound.
Some of their close relatives are actually injecting a chemical into trees, like the balsam woolly adelgid that causes that gouting on the tree. So I'm not sure if that's from the chemical or if that's a wound response, but
remarkably, in the decades we've been dealing with this whole woolly adelgid problem, we still haven't definitively figured out why or how they push the trees to death. All we can say for sure is that in 4 to 10 years, the trees succumb. Different techniques have been used to try and manage the problem, but Toman from the Department of Agriculture says this chemical pesticide is the most effective method so far. Now, there are a couple of ways to administer the pesticide. Toman and Powell and their teams of tree doctors will either bury pellets around the bottoms of the hemlock, or if there's a lot of water around, there's a more involved intervention, which requires a tree IV.
And you'll notice once we get this thing hooked up, you know, it truly has these little needle-like IV injectors that we'll put into the drill holes. And as long as the tree is taking up water right now, which it should be, you know, you'll see the insecticide quickly leave this jug and go through the tubes and eventually wind up into the tree.
So after choosing the trees that will most likely benefit from the pesticides, after measuring the trunk, taking the tree's temperature, hooking it up to an IV, and administering the pesticide, they tag the tree and move on to the next patient, tree.
What we're doing now is pressurizing the tree IV so that whenever we open the valves of those IV injectors, there's pressure behind it pushing that insecticide into the tree.
It's an involved, time-consuming, and expensive undertaking, but Mike Powell from the Nature Conservancy says it's totally worth it.
We've talked about these hemlock forests being, you know, filters for both the water we drink and the air we breathe. And, you know, not just hemlocks, but they're just one part of that more diverse forested ecosystem. And as we were talking about, you start taking away pieces of that puzzle, pieces of that forested ecosystem, and the ecosystem eventually starts to lose its functionality. It loses its ability to absorb, you know, the chemicals in the air and the things in our water. And that, you know, has long-term implications, not only for the biodiversity of the site, but also for the health of the people that are dependent upon these forests to provide those services to them.
Here at the Cranesville Swamp, which is on the border of Maryland and West Virginia, two state chapters of the Nature Conservancy, each state's Division of Agriculture, West Virginia's Division of Natural Resources, and the Forest Service have all come together to see to it that whatever can be done is being done to manage the problem. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in the Cranesville Swamp in Preston County.
I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds.
If someone calls you a butterbutt, that may sound like an insult, right? But the butterbutt, an affectionate colloquial name for the yellow-rumped warbler, is one smart cookie. In today's Bird Files segment on the Allegheny Front, Aiden Place, our resident teen birder, lets us in on the strategic eating habits of this warbler.
This time of year, the yellow-rumped warbler is mostly brown and streaked with a touch of yellow on the sides. Not the most brightly colored bird, especially when compared with other warblers. However, there's more to the yellow-rumped warbler than meets the eye. During fall migration and winter, the yellow-rumped warbler's diet expands from insects, which is the typical warbler fare. The addition? Many servings of fruit, especially bayberries. Unlike any other warbler, yellow-rumps are able to digest the waxes and bayberries. This high-energy food allows them to overwinter much farther north than other warblers, wherever the bayberries grow. The birds have been found wintering as far north as Atlantic Canada. This is remarkable, as most warblers spend the chilly months in the tropics of the southern U.S. Yellow-rumped warblers use feeding strategies that are unlike other members of the warbler family. While they do search for insects along tree branches like most warblers, they've also been known to forage by flycatching and even feeding on the ground. From autumn to spring, yellow-rumped warblers form large flocks with other warblers. They fill the woods with flitting wings and a hard chip sound. So if you're out in the woods this fall and you hear a distinctive chipping, look closely. You might just see yellow-rumped warblers. For the Allegheny Front's Bird Files, I'm Aiden Place.
Aiden Place's blog is called The Birding Place. Aiden's a sophomore at Winchester Thurston High School in Pittsburgh. Bird calls for this segment come courtesy of the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. They were recorded by Nicholas D. Sly and Michael J. Anderson. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Carol Holsoppel is the production and digital editor. Kathy Nauer is the executive producer. I'm Jennifer Schveda-Jordan. Check out our newsy Twitter feed at Allegheny Front and our Facebook page, too. And join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Laurel Foundation, and the Thompson Foundation, administered by the PNC Charitable Trust. Our coverage of the Marcellus Shale is supported by the Roy A. Hunt Foundation, the Park Foundation, and the George and Miriam Martin Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation. The Pittsburgh Foundation supports Climate Chronicles, our series on climate change.